This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll get an update in the case of Troy Anthony Davis, who has been on death row for 15 years and just had a 90-day stay of execution.
Your efforts and others around the world may have saved this man's life. We will tell you why you need to continue fighting. If you go out on the streets, there's a chance you'll be punished by the government. Our own Heidi Boghossian has written an important book on this subject called Punishing Protest.
We'll talk with author Marjorie Cohn, president of the National Lawyers Guild, about her new book, Cowboy Republic.
Marjorie Cohn describes six ways in which this administration has violated our fundamental rights. Stay with us. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
A few weeks ago, we alerted our listeners to the case of Troy Anthony Davis, a man on death row in Georgia facing imminent execution. Today, we just want to bring you an update on that. His life has been spared, at least for 90 days. We'll talk to our own Dahlia Hashad, who's been working with Amnesty International on the campaign to save Troy Davis's life. It's the beginning, we hope, of a victory, but we still need your help, and particularly Troy Davis does.
I'm actually on the West Coast for a couple of weeks, and I'm sorry I can't join you all in studio, but I did want to call in because we had a partial victory, but in the world of the death penalty, victories are rare, and so we should definitely follow up and talk about this one and let listeners know what they can do next on the case of Troy Davis. Troy Davis, as many people will remember, is an inmate on death row. We covered the segment with his sister, Martina Correa, about 2 weeks ago on Law and Disorder, and on lawanddisorder.org you can go back in the archives and listen to that half-hour segment. Troy Anthony Davis has been on death row in Georgia for over 15 years. He's an African-American in jail for the murder of a white police officer, Mark Allen McPhail, at a Burger King. This happened in Savannah, Georgia, I believe in 1989. And he has always maintained that he did not commit this murder. Now, what's really interesting about this case is there was absolutely no physical evidence presented against the defendant, Troy Davis, at trial. The weapon in the crime was never found, so they have no murder weapon. The case against him consisted of witness testimony. Since then, seven of the nine non-police witnesses have either recanted or completely contradicted their testimony. When you look at the individual cases of folks saying what happened to them and why they testified against Troy Davis, it's actually pretty shocking. A lot of people have said we were coerced by the police, and that's been the one consistent factor in all of these witness testimonies, that people felt like they did not have a choice but in the face of this immense police pressure to say that Troy Davis committed the murders, even though they knew that not to be true. When you look at who didn't recant their testimony, because you have these testimonies, these nine testimonies, based on police coercion and people saying, look, I've recanted them. When you look at the two people who said that they didn't recant, one of them is the principal alternative suspect, and you have about a dozen people in sworn affidavits saying they saw him commit the crime, or he had later admitted to them that he committed the crime. Or you have the other individual who has not been found. They can't find this person to ask them if there was any police pressure involved. Now, despite all this, Troy Davis has never had a hearing in federal court on the reliability of the witness testimony used against him. In other words, we just haven't seen a day in court where Troy Davis was able to present the facts.
Why was that, Dahlia? Did he have bad lawyers?
Well, unfortunately, he has bad law, the same bad law that all of us have. The 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty.
That's a President Clinton special, right?
That's President Clinton's. And unfortunately, what we get out of there is to really streamline these cases and the death penalty straight to execution so that people have less and less of an opportunity to raise important claims, such as innocence claims like this. And so after he was convicted in the post-conviction stage, he has not been able to raise these issues to say, look, people have recanted, and a lot of these people didn't, you know, one person recanted at trial, but a lot of these people did not recant until after he was convicted. And that, as you can imagine, problematic, that we have really convincing evidence that this man is innocent. He was scheduled for execution a few days ago. And the exciting update is that the Georgia Board of Paroles and Pardons has issued him a 90-day stay of execution.
Dahlia, yeah. How many hours before his actual execution time was that order issued?
Less than 24.
So he was basically ready to be executed within a 24-hour period, and what, this 90-day stay happened, is that it?
Yeah, he was preparing, Troy Anthony Davis was preparing for the end of his life, for his murder, his execution.
We're talking with our own Dahlia Hashad, who's calling in from California and who's been following with Amnesty International the Troy Davis execution, which has been put off for 90 days. Dahlia, how do you account for this partial victory in putting it off?
Well, you know, first let me tell you what the 90 days means. The 90-day stay of execution means that the Georgia Board of Paroles has responded to the immense outcry from people all around the world who have said, look, there's something that really stinks in the state of Georgia, and we are really upset about this case. An innocent man, a man who's very likely to be innocent, could be executed very soon, and we want you to use your powers to stop it. So they have issued a very rare 90-day stay, which would allow them to investigate a little bit more, meaning that the defense would have an opportunity to try to bring forth some of these people who have recanted in sworn affidavits their testimony saying that this man, Troy Davis, committed this murder. The problem is a lot of these people, I imagine, are really hard to find.
So wait, he got this 90-day stay. There's these witnesses they're trying to find who recanted, et cetera. Is there going to be a hearing before the parole board, the court? I don't get it.
My understanding is that there could be a hearing before the parole board. I'm not certain if there will be a hearing before the parole board, but they're just extending the execution date. If there will be a hearing before the parole board, that's an opportunity for the defense then to try to bring up these other witnesses. Otherwise, the parole board, at their discretion, could decide at any time that they will execute Troy Davis. So they could decide today that he should be executed in the next few days, and they could lift the stay. What was so convincing to people that they needed to contact the Georgia Board of Paroles and to let them know that this was a miscarriage of justice is the testimony that from the sworn affidavits of individuals who had previously said Troy Davis did it.
You know, Dahlia, it reminds me a little bit of, you know, we followed closely here the Mamiya case, obviously, an alleged killing by a black man. And, of course, you know, similar kinds of things happen. Witnesses have recanted in that case. His case is now even older than Troy's. Troy's been on death row since 91, is that right?
He's been on death row for 15 years.
15 years, right. So, no, that's really remarkable.
Obviously, he has new appellate lawyers, or appellate lawyers differing from the ones at the trial, correct?
Yeah, and you know what? What Floyd Davis has said is because there is no money for the public, you know, for public defenders in the state of Georgia and for death penalty defense attorneys who have taken up his case, he said he really felt like the hands of his attorneys again and again were tied. No money for investigation, no money to track down witnesses, no money to be paid for the hours that they worked on the cases. So no matter how willing people were to take on cases like these and his case, they needed to feed their own families as well, and they could not give this case the kind of attention it deserves because this is not federally funded. This is not state funded in the state of Georgia.
There's another element here, Dahlia, that's troubling. Under the effective death penalty and Anti-Terrorism Act of 1996, Clinton's Act, and I'm going to ask this question of Michael Ratner, our resident constitutional scholar. I remember Bill Kunstler remarking when cases would come up under this act, evidence of innocence wasn't allowed. Kunstler remarking how decadent the system is that would exclude evidence of innocence. And does this have...
Well, they allow evidence of innocence just so it's not too late. Yeah. If it's within a year, right, yeah. Dahlia? Isn't that the rule? But if it's after a year, evidence of innocence is buried with the alleged criminal. Dahlia, you should actually give our listeners, I mean, I think the effort that they made, obviously, all our listeners and all around the world and some that you're describing, probably was very significant in saving Troy's life, even for the 90 days, we hope.
We have a further request to please send appeals as quickly as possible to the Georgia State Board of Paroles and Pardons. And in that appeal, we're asking people to welcome the board's decision, of course, for the stay, but to also talk about the many witnesses who have testified that they were forced into false testimony against Troy Davis.
Dahlia, I found it very helpful checking the Amnesty International website because you have information that people can read up before they write that appeal letter. What's that site?
They can, amnestyusa.org, and just look for the death penalty tab on there, or amnestyusa.org/abolish. But if you don't have internet access, I'll give you a fax number. You want to send it to the State Board of Pardons and Paroles, 404-651-8502.
Dahlia, this is one of those small yet important victories, and we're so glad that you could join us. We miss you. We'll see you soon.
Yeah, we'll see you guys soon.
Okay, Dahlia, thanks.
Thanks, Dahlia.
Today, we're absolutely thrilled and excited to talk about a book done by one of our own, by the famous Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild. Heidi just handed me the book. It's actually free. You can go to the National Lawyers Guild website and get it, and I'll tell you that in a second. But the book is called Punishing Protest, Government Tactics That Suppress Free Speech. And it is utterly remarkable. I mean, straightforward, lays out how the government, particularly since 9/11, has made it difficult, if not impossible, for us to protest government policies. It has chapters such as terrorist label applied to activists, a catalog of unlawful government tactics, going from having to pay for permits to searches, to the pens you've seen set up in the demonstrations, to using vehicles as weapons. It has chapters on police lies, tampering, and videotapes, and of course a study of bicyclists under fire in New York in particular, but really around the country. This is a book that talks about punishing protest throughout the country and how our key right to change this government is being taken away. You can get this book for free. Heidi, how?
You can go on to wwnlg.org. There will be information. I think we just are asking for postage and an envelope, and we'll send you a free copy.
Postage is what, about $10?
It's gone up a lot, yeah.
It should really be about a dollar.
For this.
But it's an amazing thing. Michael, I mean, I just can't get over this book.
Oh, thank you, Michael.
Heidi, tell us, what was it that brought you to write Punishing Protest?
Well, in 2004, we wrote another report called The Assault on Free Speech, Public Assembly, and Dissent. It came out right after the Republican National Convention, and it basically cataloged a whole range of police tactics that the Guild had been hearing about and observing from our work monitoring First Amendment-protected activities in the streets. It had things like using motorcycles and horses in what we call the rush tactic to hoard protesters into a corner, basically surround them by the motorcycles or the horses, then sweep in and conduct what we call false arrests. That's basically arrests that are not based on probable cause. And several independent review commissions came out with reports after that and after protests in, at the FTAA demos in Miami, finding that, in fact, the real motivation for the police doing this was to keep people out of the street and out of the eyes of the mass media. So we were collecting information after that, and suddenly I realized, well, things have escalated. It's not just a catalog of police tactics in the streets that's very well coordinated from all levels of government and implemented basically all around the country. We see larger trends.
In major cities all around the country. Yeah.
Right. But what we started to see was larger trends that were very disturbing. Using the word terrorist to define domestic activists for things that had gone on over the years and perhaps been considered acts of civil disobedience or even acts of sabotage, property destruction, aimed at drawing attention to a social cause and calling on the government to really improve its policies. So it's not for subversive activities. By no stretch of the imagination should these actions be called terrorist, because our penal code already provides for numerous punishments, arson charges, property destruction, trespassing, and the like. Then we started to see some things that were happening in New York as well as around the country, but one that noticeably was occurring in New York with a different level of attention was police presence and monitoring of the monthly bicycle ride called Critical Mass that you may be aware of.
Yeah, of course. Tell us the story, what the cops are trying to do to them.
Well, the police officers arrive en masse to these events, and what we saw was that they were arresting protesters on petty charges and taking them away to prison or just keeping them overnight. And the New York Times commented on the vast amount of resources. In 2006, they said that the police deemed Critical Mass an illegal parade and have drafted a law that would ban it, basically requiring that a certain number of bicyclists would have to apply for a parade permit. Now, we noticed that these Critical Mass rides have been going on for years, not only in New York City, but all around the country without any police attention. In fact, at the beginning of them, I think the police often rode with them but left them alone. In 2006, the police department tried to enact regulations, which they ultimately were successful in doing, that would create these rather onerous permit regulations and that would arguably affect other people engaged in lawful First Amendment activities, tourists, children on a little trip. It would become cumbersome, and we felt it would have what is called a chilling effect on free speech.
Tell us who it was that you worked with on putting together Punishing Protest, because the Guild has got a network of movement lawyers out there that try to protect the movement when it's in the streets. And this book seems to me to be like the encyclopedia of what we've learned since 9/11 on this whole new government effort to punish protest.
The Guild has literally hundreds of attorneys, law students, legal workers who participate in what we call a legal observing program. So that if a law student is busy but likes the mission of the Guild and wants to get involved, he or she can go to a training, learn what they have to look out for, the things to be aware of at a mass demonstration or even a local demonstration, say in Philadelphia or in the country somewhere. they look for police abuse of First Amendment lawful activity. So that if a police officer says you can't stand there, you can't hold the flag, we try to educate them about the local laws and the general do's and don'ts of law enforcement. We've been doing this since the 1970s when the New York City chapter of the Guild started the Legal Observer programming in response to the protests at Columbia University. And I believe Michael Ratner was involved.
It was 1968, April 1968. I was there. These huge, beefy, longshoreman-type cops come on campus at night. It was actually the first, I think, use of cops on a northern campus in many, many years. They really beat the heck out of all of us, a lot of people. It was the days, of course, when SDS had taken over the buildings. I had come up for one day and guarded a building and, of course, was picked up like a matchstick. But, you know, the Guild lawyers played an incredible role in that. Not only the Guild lawyers from the older days, from the 30s, from the thing called the International Labor Defense, which had been set up to protect labor unions in the 30s, going forward to the young lawyers who were unfortunately now older lawyers like me, and people like Jerry Lefcourt, Lenny Wineglass, I mean, Bill Kunstler, all of them were there at the time.
And we have a new generation of Guild attorneys in New York City especially, and we've had several of them on the show here, who make their practice based on defending First Amendment rights. And I think in New York City we have a perfect place to do that because we've seen so many unlawful infringements on basic, just the right to protest. So this report is a culmination of the work that people are doing all around the country. You'll see a few photographs. One young member of ours followed a police officer who, in his turn, was following and videotaping a group of protesters after a silent die-in at the Republican convention in 2004. He literally got on the subway and was videotaping people. And we have a photograph of that officer with his video camera pointed at our own photographer. But we have examples of lawsuits that Guild members have brought all around the country challenging unlawful police practices, resulting often in consent decrees aimed at making police do the right thing.
We're speaking with our own Heidi Bogosian, the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. She's just put out a book called Punishing Protest, Government Tactics That Suppress Free Speech. The book is available to anybody that wants it. They can come to our website, lawanddisorder.org, and we'll link to the Guild website so you can send away for it. But Heidi, I wanted you to talk about the hierarchy of government attacks to the First Amendment. Give us an idea of what they're doing to suppress First Amendment liberties.
Well, the report is actually organized in terms of different layers. We call it a hierarchy of attacks. One occurs in the streets, and we've talked about arresting demonstrators en masse without probable cause. Also, the use of so-called less lethal munitions, that's pepper spray, projectile weapons, basically against passive protesters, people who are just standing there, maybe penned in the way they do it in New York so they can't move. This is a practice that has been universally condemned as violating human rights. Altering evidence we've seen in New York where police during the Republican convention committed perjury, conducted false arrests, and actually altered several videotapes that would have exonerated the people who were arrested had they allowed the whole tape to be shown intact. We then see, on a slightly higher level, city and state, as I mentioned, regulations that were aimed at bicycle activists. The danger of this is regulations are being promulgated that target specific people based on what they do. That is inadvisable. We have state legislation that also punishes actions more severely if motivated by a particular ideology. And the example that we have here is, and it's we're seeing it also at a federal level, the government has called animal rights activists and environmental rights activists the number one domestic terrorism threat. And they just passed, December 2006, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which basically means that if you're a protester for animal rights and you organize a boycott, and the boycott or the picket causes any financial loss to the animal enterprise, and that means a business that does perhaps test animals, or they even include tertiary targets, that is, a business that may deliver eggs to a farm or something.
What if I advertise that I only eat organic and encourage people to only eat organic?
Put me away, Michael.
Michael, it sounds far-fetched, but we don't know what this law, we haven't seen it tested yet. A case hasn't been brought. We're waiting to see the extent of it, because things like going undercover into an animal laboratory, arguably, if you're an undercover employee, that's causing loss of profits to the business, and you might be persecuted under this,
A distortion.
I could wear my chicken outfit.
But going back to the hierarchy of government attacks on the First Amendment, Heidi, what about the loosening of restrictions like the consent decree that we had here in New York, the handshoe case? That's been a national phenomenon.
It is a national phenomenon. For listeners, a consent decree is basically a settlement when, say, the guild sues the LAPD. Without an admission of guilt, the LAPD may agree to change some of its policies. Training police, for example, how to handle protesters. You can't fly your helicopters too low, so low that you're drowning out the sound of the speaker. You can't arrest them without being able to prove that you saw something that could amount to probable cause.
You can't send an agent into their peace organization to spy and report.
Yes, although you know that is happening.
That's been reversed, yeah.
But anyway, we set, and I'm not talking just about the Guild, but many other organizations around the country who've been vigilant about police abuse of authority, have brought suits, been successful in setting consent decrees, and that basically keeps the police department on their toes and holds them accountable. But we're seeing these consent decrees being loosened in some instances around the country, being done away with altogether. And that's definitely a trend that we've seen escalate under the Bush administration.
Well, we saw that in New York City when the mayor hired a top CIA official to come in here and work on political stuff for the New York City Police Department. And the first target was the handshoe decree. But let me ask you, with respect to chilling free speech at the federal level, what kind of trends have you seen there?
Well, as everyone's aware, and we've covered on Law and Disorder, we've seen a great increase in not only government surveillance, but actual data gathering on Americans, largely based on political ideology. We've also seen the use of grand juries, once again, as we have always seen, but especially in the Vietnam War days, we saw grand juries being used to try to get information from people about their families, their friends, their political beliefs. We saw that at the RNC that police were asking, handing out questionnaires, asking for people's political beliefs on paper, things like that. And we've seen increased sharing of this information all around the country.
Yeah.
And a high rate of misinformation. That's really key, is that the government itself has admitted they can't guarantee the integrity of this data, and there is a lot of misinformation.
I want to again say we're talking to Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild. She has a new book called Punishing Protest, Government Tactics That Suppress Free Speech. What's wonderful about this book, it's laid out in a format that's very easy to follow. There's large boxes that summarize the points. There's wonderful pictures of not only the cops, but of some heroic protesters and guild lawyers. And it also has lists and then explains various tactics that the government has used to suppress protest. There's a whole list of like maybe 20 of them, and I would have Heidi go through every one, but there's a couple that I just want to ask about. What's a snatch squad?
A snatch squad is something we've seen in other countries, and we've seen that it's making its way into the lexicon of United States law enforcement. That's where, believe it or not, police officers, usually 1 to 4, often wearing black masks with the eyes cut out. Very sinister. We have photos of that. Not in this report, but we have guild members who've witnessed it. They go and they identify a protester in a crowd, and they go and literally pluck that person out of the crowd. Now, what we tried to do in this report to keep it from becoming too dry was start every chapter with a long quotation from a guild member or friend who had been either the victim of one of the tactics we mentioned or whose experience related to the theme of that chapter. And for snatch squads, one of our guild legal observers, Miles Swanson, had been at the FTAA demonstrations wearing his green, lime green legal observer hat. And interestingly enough, we found out that the police department in Miami had gotten a picture of Miles wearing his hat, and they showed it with a PowerPoint demonstration to local merchants, identifying him as a legal observer and saying that you should watch out for these guild observers. Miles was literally pulled off the street by officers who were driving around in a van and saw him. They were wearing ski masks, dressed in black. They punched him, pushed him to the ground. This is all in his quotation that he has. He was dragged into the van, had his life threatened. When he tells this story, we're so used to it in the guild that, you know, we know these things happen routinely. But when other people read these stories, they're like, really? This
happened? Even I would look at this a lot, obviously, as a civil liberties lawyer, human rights lawyer. And the way they arrest and detain Guantanamo people is they basically fly around the world on these jets. They stop in Italy or wherever. And about 10 guys, all in black, with black masks, get off the plane. They grab the guy. They then strip him, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the same. It's basically overseas, and now they have it here. It's pretty shocking.
Honey. It is shocking.
I mean, that is really serious. And it's not just on Halloween they do this, right?
No, and we actually have photographs going back to Seattle protests where I think photographers were literally picked up and taken away by snatch squads. So they're also going after the press.
We've been talking with our own Heidi Boghossian, who's given us a tremendous gift with her work on putting out, just published, Punishing Protest, Government Tactics That Suppress Free Speech. Heidi Boghossian and the National Lawyers Guild are being congratulated for this project. You can go to our website, lawanddisorder.org. You'll send us postage, and we'll send you a copy of this book for free. And we want to thank Heidi for the hard work and Heidi's comrades who worked with her to put out Punishing Protest. Really good work, Heidi.
Thank you.
Yes, congratulations, Heidi. It's really an important book documenting a particular moment and a particularly bad moment in our history.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. National Lawyers Guild president, legal scholar, and co-author of Cameras in the Courtroom, Television and the Pursuit of Justice, Marjorie Cohn has written a new book titled Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. She provides an in-depth analysis of six significant ways in which the Bush administration has undermined the rule of law in this country. Professor Cohn details the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq, the policy of torture, war crimes, kangaroo courts of Guantanamo, unconstitutional laws, and the unlawful surveillance of American citizens. Her book contains practical ways to strengthen the rule of law, both domestically and internationally, including political and legal remedies. Marjorie, welcome once again to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's my pleasure, Heidi.
Marjorie, it's Michael Smith here. It's so good to have you on again and to see this book. It really is what we've been trying to do for the last 3.5 years, and you put it all together in a couple hundred pages. It's really an excellent job. Thank you.
Well, really, I enjoyed writing it, and I'm just glad that it's getting out and it's going to be useful to people.
So tell us and our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to write Cowboy Republic.
Well, I'll have to go back to high school, where I was a cheerleader and a homecoming princess and thought that my government was beyond reproach, and happily went off to Stanford as a freshman, and that was, of course, right in the middle of the Vietnam War in 1967, 68, 69. And I happened to see a film. It was kind of a grainy black and white film of a young girl, maybe 12 years old, without any clothes on, running from a U.S. warplane that had just dropped napalm on her. And she was burning from the napalm. And I had, for me, it was just a gut reaction that war had to stop, that I had to do what I could to stop it. It was not an intellectual decision that I came to after studying. But then I did start studying and joined the anti-war movement. At one point, we had 2,000 Stanford students who occupied the Applied Electronics Laboratory at Stanford, which was doing chemical and biological warfare research, of all things. And that really set me on the path of being a political person, and then when I went to law school, a political lawyer. And the National Lawyers Guild has been central to my political development, and it has provided me with a real support system of people who are doing progressive work, who are taking on the big issues like U.S. imperialism, racism, sexism, etc.
So, now, Marjorie, of course, the image that you talked about is a very famous one in the Vietnam War, the napalming of villages and that young girl running, really. I was actually just at an exhibit at the Whitney called Summer of Love, but of course that summer, 67, was no summer of love for a lot of people in Vietnam as well as in Newark. But it did have a picture of that image, and across the image it said, you know, stop the war now, get out of Vietnam. So it was a really iconic image of the war.
And, you know, the Bush administration learned from that war. They didn't learn enough not to get into another illegal, immoral war, but they certainly learned that you keep those images off TV. And another thing during the Vietnam War that really, really changed a lot of minds were the body bags of U.S. soldiers coming back. And, of course, we don't see that now. We don't see the flag-draped coffins. Bush doesn't go to funerals when soldiers are killed.
So, you know, the lawsuit to try and get those bodies shown to have press there when they come off the plane was litigated during the first Iraq war and was lost, saying it was up to the administration whether to show those bodies.
You know, this morning there was a very important vote in the Senate about ending the war and bringing the troops home, and I went downstairs, I was having breakfast, and I turned on my TV, and I flipped around from channel to channel trying to find out what had happened, and, you know, all I could find out was what the latest was on the D.C. Madam case. And that was pretty much it, and I had a hell of a time. I had to go on the Internet and finally find out what the vote was, and, of course, the Democrats lost. But I couldn't find it, and that's why Americans really are shielded from so much of the truth, although not so much that they are not overwhelmingly opposed to the war and opposed to the president.
Marjorie, I know we want to talk about the book, but now that you mentioned the war vote, we're recording this a couple of days before, but it did happen the day we're recording, and I just got an email, and it just says DOD authorization was just pulled, Department of Defense authorization just pulled, no habeas vote. We tried to get habeas in their restoration in the Senate. We thought, a number of votes. They apparently didn't do it. And then it says no Iraq vote. I mean, I know that the fact that the Democrats couldn't even get themselves to get a habeas vote or an Iraq vote is pretty shocking.
It is shocking, and especially, Michael, because many Republicans want the war to end because it's a political liability for them and they have to run for re-election. But they've promised the Republican leadership that they will hold off until September when General Petraeus gives his so-called update. And, of course, that's a totally artificial deadline. But think about how many U.S. soldiers and how many thousands of Iraqis are going to die in the next 2 months while the Republicans are fiddling around with their political considerations.
Right. The update is really about how many, well, in my view, should be just how many people were killed, as you're saying.
Absolutely.
Marjorie, you've written really a gem of a book, Cowboy Republic, and in it you describe essentially six key ways that the current Bush administration has really undermined the rule of law in this country. Let's start with an overview of those six ways.
Okay, and I just want to say, Heidi, that of course there are many more than six ways that the Bush gang, and I call them a gang because that's how they act, have broken the law, but I didn't have the time or the resources to write a book that would probably be as long as Webster's Unabridged Dictionary. I wanted a small volume that people, that could help people, that was clear, and that focused on the six most egregious violations of the law, which is why I've limited it to six. The first is a war of aggression, which, of course, is what is taking place in Iraq, which is illegal, not just immoral. It violates the UN Charter, which is a treaty we've ratified, therefore part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, because it was not undertaken in self-defense and the Security Council didn't approve it. And I also chronicle the real motive that we went in there. That was, of course, to change the regime of Saddam Hussein because he was not favorable to the privatization of Iraqi oil so that oil companies could make more profit. And there is all kinds of documentation of that fact. And in fact, what's happening now corroborates that, and that is that Bush and Cheney have no intention of ever leaving Iraq because they're building huge mega bases and the biggest embassy in the world in Iraq. And the big so-called benchmark for the progress that Iraqis are making, which is touted by Bush, the Iraq Study Group, and even Congress, is the so-called Iraq Oil Law, which in fact would turn over control of the majority of Iraq's oil to foreign oil companies. That's really what it's all about. So that's the first. The second is the torture of prisoners. We've all seen those horrible photographs from Abu Ghraib prison, but that, of course, is just the tip of the iceberg. Torture and abuse of prisoners in U.S. custody is going on all over Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo, and the secret CIA black sites around the world. That violates U.S. law, violates treaties we've ratified, part of U.S. law, and also U.S. statutes. And it's part of a common plan to violate the Geneva Conventions, and I document that as well. Bush's so-called legal eagles, David Addington, John Yoo, wrote torture memos to justify torture and also to provide arguments that the Bush administration could use to keep them from incurring criminal liability under the U.S. war crimes statute. The next is summary execution and willful killing, and that's the war crimes that are being committed in Haditha and all over Iraq, and that's the cold-blooded killing of civilians and poisonous weapons that are really weapons of mass destruction, cluster bombs, depleted uranium, white phosphorus gas that burns to the bone. These war crimes are being committed pursuant to rules of engagement that are set at the top of the command, the commander-in-chief's office, and that is, once again, just like Vietnam, free fire zones where they shoot at anything that moves. These young GIs are put in a position of having to commit war crimes, these assassinations or extrajudicial killings where in Yemen or in Somalia, and we hardly hear about this in the news, Bush decides there's some suspected al-Qaeda people, so he just takes them out, bombs them. No due process, nothing. And in fact, many turn out to be women and children and innocent people. And even if they were al-Qaeda, they should be arrested and tried.
Marjorie, can rules of engagement be changed from invasion to invasion? I'm not going to say war, but that's something that the commander-in-chief can decide from time to time?
Yes, absolutely. And it goes from the commander-in-chief to the joint chiefs and the top generals and people who are in charge. Yes, absolutely. Those rules come from the top. And they can be changed from conflict to conflict. And we see many parallels with Vietnam, and that's one of them. Then we have spying on Americans. This is Bush's secret spying program that became public when the New York Times broke the story. We don't know about all of the other secret programs where they're doing surveillance and watching us. We just know about this one. In fact, Bush has admitted to it. And it is being undertaken in direct violation of a law that Congress passed and the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed in 1978 in response to the excesses of the FBI, COINTELPRO, I'm sure you've talked about on this show, and the Nixon administration's illegal surveillance of its political enemies. And FISA makes very clear that it and some provisions of the federal criminal statute are the exclusive means for wiretapping and electronic surveillance. It's a secret court. The Bush administration has gotten almost every wiretap order that it's applied for, and yet Bush feels compelled to make an end run around Congress and the courts and spy on us.
Marjorie, I just want to interrupt you for a second to remind our listeners who might have just tuned into Law and Disorder that we're speaking with Marjorie Cohn, who's the president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's just written this wonderful book, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law, and she's been recounting to us, sadly, these six ways. Marjorie, I wanted to ask you about the Guantanamo Gulag and the refusing to execute the law that Bush has been doing.
Right, right. The Guantanamo Gulag, everyone knows about the outrage that is happening in Guantanamo Bay. And that is the place where the Bush administration is sending people, undesirables, even though none of them have been tried for any crimes. In fact, most of them will never see the inside of a courtroom. And the reason that they chose Guantanamo is because they thought they would have a legal black hole where U.S. courts could not reach. Of course, the Supreme Court disagreed with that and held very clearly that the U.S. exercises complete jurisdiction over the Guantanamo Bay base. And so, in fact, they're trying to keep them from getting habeas corpus. The Bush administration rammed the Military Commissions Act through Congress, which is still in shock from 9/11. The rest of us have moved on, and we know that, yes, terrorism is a problem, but the terrorists in the White House are also a big problem, and the majority of the people oppose the war. But Congress is still in shock after giving Bush the Patriot Act, the Iraq War, and the Military Commissions Act. Now, of course, they're debating what to do about the Iraq War. But the Military Commissions Act strips habeas corpus from habeas corpus rights, in other words, the right to go into federal court to challenge the basis for the detention of these people who are being held for years and years and years and maybe forever, even though that is unconstitutional. And that's what Michael was referring to earlier, which was an attempt in Congress to try to restore habeas corpus. But also what's coming from Guantanamo are reports of torture and abuse, and it's such a depressing, demoralizing place where people realize that they may never see the light of day, even though they're never charged with a crime, which is totally anathema to our justice system. And so many of them have engaged in hunger strikes where they stop eating. And it's very embarrassing to the Bush administration if prisoners in U.S. custody die of a hunger strike. So they have enlisted the help of doctors, and this violates the American Medical Association canons, to force-feed the prisoners, where they stick big plastic tubes down their throats and into their stomachs. The UN has called it torture. It's so painful. They don't use anesthesia. They don't sterilize the tubes between uses. In fact, some prisoners can see the blood and bile from other prisoners on the tube before it goes down their own throat. They tie them down, and they do this. Nevertheless, three prisoners have succeeded in committing suicide. And, of course, the Bush administration spins those tragedies and calls it asymmetrical warfare. So the Guantanamo Gulag is really, I think, maybe more than anything else, the symbol of American hypocrisy when the U.S. government looks at other countries and criticizes their human rights records, and then what's happening in Guantanamo really personifies the most egregious human rights violations. And then we have the refusing to execute the law, and that has to do with Bush's signing statements. The Constitution gives Congress the right, the power, to pass laws. And after two houses of Congress pass a law, the president has only two choices. He can sign the law or he can veto it. That's it. Bush has vetoed only three laws, the two stem cell research bills and the Iraq spending bill that had a timetable on it a few months ago. But what he does is to attach these signing statements which say, I'm the commander-in-chief and I will follow only those parts of the law that I agree with or that I think are wise. A direct slap at the executive branch of government. And other presidents have used these signing statements, but none to the extent that Bush has. He has entered signing statements to more than 1,000 laws. And I just want to tell you something that is not talked about much, and I think people really need to understand. Bush often talks about how he supports the troops. This is like a mantra. He waves the flag and he supports the troops. Of course, many of them are on their fifth tour of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. But let me just tell you a couple of signing statements that he attached to bills that he signed and see if you think he really does support the troops. One of his signing statements scoffed at the limits that Congress placed on the number of days a soldier could be deployed. He also reserved the right to disobey Congress's mandate that the Secretary of Defense has to report to Congress about whether the prohibition against requiring injured troops to pay for their hospital meals is being enforced, and also about the effectiveness of detection and diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. And finally, he signed away his obligation to have his defense secretary institute studies on brain injuries suffered by our troops and mental health benefits for members of the armed forces. Now, does that sound like he's supporting the troops?
We never thought he was.
Marjorie, you've raised some stinging indictments against this cowboy administration. What can we do to stop the cowboy Republicans?
That's an excellent question, Heidi. First of all, there is resistance within the military, like the GI movement during Vietnam. It was a central part of the anti-war movement and instrumental in ending that war. There is quite a bit of resistance, individual resistance, within the military. Beyond that, the Founding Fathers put into the Constitution a very clear procedure that applies more than ever in a situation like this, and that is not lying about sex, which was the grounds for impeaching Clinton, but lying about getting into an unnecessary and illegal war that has resulted in the deaths of more than 3,600 Americans, tens of thousands of Iraqis, and thousands of injured soldiers, to say nothing of the hit that our economy is taking with this war tab. And the torture of prisoners, the war crimes, the breaking the law by spying on Americans, etc., and what's happening at Guantanamo, all provide really the quintessential essence of high crimes and misdemeanors. And that's, of course, impeachment. But it doesn't stop there. It's not, and not that it's a just, not that impeachment is a just, but it doesn't stop there. These people, these members of the Bush gang, the inner circle, need to be tried for criminal offenses. They need to be held responsible for their crimes.
Right on,
Marjorie. Be punished.
How do we get from where we are to that point?
Well, first of all, people need to educate themselves, like listening to this radio broadcast, reading books like the one I wrote.
Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law by Marjorie Cohn.
And you know what's great about the book is it's really accessible. You're not going to open the book and put it down because it reads quickly, it reads well, and it gives you the overview in a way that I don't think I've read another book that does that that's just as accessible. So really, congratulations. Yeah. And I really recommend people to go to the different websites. Marjorie, I think you have a website for this book?
Yeah, it's at marjoriecohn.com where you can order the book, but also my articles are archived there, and they talk about a lot of the same things that are in the book, but certainly the book was out of date as soon as it went to press, and things are happening every single day that give even more support to this whole idea of the Bush gang committing crimes. But just to briefly answer your question, people need to write letters to the editor, op-eds, email and call Congress people, join in marches and demonstrations to register their opposition, and demand that Congress hold hearings, and when the Bush administration stonewalls to do investigations and initiate impeachment and also appoint a special independent prosecutor, because certainly Alberto Gonzalez has a conflict of interest since he's one of the war criminals, to investigate crimes against the Bush administration.
Marjorie, I wanted to go back to the title of your book, Cowboy Republic. I remember after the anti-war movement, when people were trying to come to grips with the radicalization in this country, and one of the leaders of SDS, a guy named Carl Davidson, wrote a well-known in those days essay where he talked about a division of interests amongst the elite that run this country. And he called part of that elite the cowboys. You remember that? And the cowboys were like the oil and gas interests and the defense industry, the people that supported kind of like the far right. And I just wondered, when I saw the title of your book, Cowboy Republic, whether you had that in mind when you gave it its title.
You know, I think I might have subconsciously, because I, now that you mention it, recall that article, but I was thinking more of the Webster's Dictionary. Of course, cowboy has a lot of very positive connotations, the rugged independence, freedom, self-sufficiency, international icon. But Webster's also has a definition of cowboy which is less flattering, and that is someone who undertakes a dangerous or sensitive task needlessly, and that's what I had in mind. I wish I had remembered, actually, that Davidson essay, because I certainly would have referred to it, but I appreciate your reminding me.
A recklessness.
Yes, exactly, recklessness. But I think it even goes beyond recklessness, because it's really intentional. You know, when people say, oh, the war was a mistake and it's not being fought competently, you know, I think that really, really understates a very systematic, deliberate, intentional plan on the part of the Bush gang to sell that war and to really use lies and misrepresentations to convince Congress and the American people that Iraq constituted a threat to us.
Yeah, I agree. It lets them off the hook. But, you know, I think that the other part of the cowboy that Davidson was referring to, the other part of the elite, still supports this war. What bothers me about the show that the Democrats are putting on now, with the putting cots in the meeting rooms and staying up all night to debate the thing, is that their own plan is not for withdrawal, immediate or otherwise. It's for still keeping tens of thousands of troops in Iraq, and most of them also support that law that would denationalize Iraq's oil. The virus of cowboyness has spread throughout the entire ruling elite in this country. It's our oil under their sand, and they want to keep it, and they want to keep how many troops there they can get away with keeping.
Absolutely, Michael. I mean, I don't hear any of the major Democratic proposals talking about pulling those military bases out of there. That occupation is going to continue. We still have those mega bases, that big embassy, and they're still pushing for this oil law, and I don't know what's going to happen with it, but that really goes to the heart of Iraqi sovereignty, and I think ultimately, just like during the Vietnam War, it's going to be Iraqis who end this war.
The book is called Cowboy Republic by Marjorie Cohn, C-O-H-N. It's published by Polypoint Press, and it's available on Amazon, online, on the Guild's website, nlg.org, and it's a must-read. Thank you, Marjorie.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Marjorie Cohn. Your columns can be seen at MarjorieCohn.com. We encourage all our listeners to read Marjorie. You'll get an extension of our program if you read her articles. They're excellent. Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Thanks, Marjorie.
Here.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
You can also visit Michael Ratner's new blog, justleft.org. It contains writings by Michael, as well as contributions from other progressive thinkers around the country. That's justleft.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.